There was this little girl in art class, and she was drawing, and she was very excited about drawing, and the teacher came over and asked over her shoulder, she says, what are you doing there, honey? And the little girl says, well, I'm drawing God. And she's got this great big swirls, and she's got great big expanse on this piece of paper. She's taken up the whole sheet of paper to draw her picture. And the teacher was somewhat theologically versed. So she said to her, she says, well, you know, nobody really knows what God looks like. And the girl stuck out her tongue in concentration and said, well, they will in a minute. The lesson for today is that God is a personal God. That's what we're doing in our core discipleship. That's what we're doing in the theme for today, that God is personal. And that means that unlike other religions, unlike philosophy, that God comes to us personally, one to one. Not just one to one, but in addition to. You know, God comes to us as a congregation. God comes to us one to one through the power of the Holy Spirit. How many people have been comforted by hearing the words, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. God is a personal God. And we heard this story in Matthew chapter 1 of how personal God can get. It doesn't get any more personal than the story of Mary and Joseph waiting for the birth of Jesus Christ. It is the most personal of acts, God coming to someone in dreams. God comes to us in our hopes and in our desires. God comes to us in many, many different ways, many of which are personal. Now, some people, they say, well, there seems to be a problem because you say that God is personal, but how come no angel has ever appeared to me in a dream? It's just not as dramatic today. You say God is personal, but it seems like in the year 2015 now that God seems pretty far away from us. It's not all these angels like happens all the time in the Bible. And I've never had a really good answer for that, except one of my favorite writers on these sorts of issues is a Swiss pastor called Karl Barth. And he wrote in the 20th century. And his answer was, when Jesus has something really important to tell you, as important as the message that God delivered to Matthew or to Joseph and to Mary, well, then you'll get an angel. His answer basically is, when God has something that important to say, then you'll see an angel. I kind of like that idea, that's why God sends an angel, because this is really important. This isn't like somewhat important. This is world-changing important. And when God has the news to give you, then you will have this message in such a dramatic fashion. And it's important for us, even though we aren't nearly as dramatic, is to really focus on what God gives us in our dreams and visions and hopes for the future. The Bible is a book of hoping about the future. It's shot through with hope for what comes next. And that goes from Joseph receiving dreams in Matthew's gospel. It goes from all sorts of different places where God intervenes in ways that we can't possibly imagine. Now, dreams are important to us, but they seem to fade over time. If you ask a 5-year-old about his future, what are you going to do when you grow up? Oh, I'm going to be a fireman, and I'm going to discover the cure for cancer, and I'm going to be an astronaut, and after that, when I'm 30, then I'm going to, you know, I mean, kids have expansive dreams, huge dreams, and God love them for it. But you ask me about what I'm going to do this year, well, I'll probably lower my cholesterol a few points, and hopefully I'll get a couple pounds off that I put on over the holiday, and maybe I might, you know, paint in the basement a little bit. We're much more mundane as adults than we were as kids. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't really have to be that way. And I would suggest to you that we suffer when we've chopped our dreams down a little bit, that we've sort of put blinders on. We're very practical people, and that's not always a bad thing, but we need to dream bigger. We need to dream greater. As we age, we tend to dream small. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because reality has a lot of little things we have to deal with. We have a lot of demands on our time. There are bills to be paid and mortgages and things to figure out. There are degrees to be had. There are children to raise. But it doesn't have to be that way as we age. One of my favorite figures from history is Anthony of Egypt. Don't know if you've ever heard of Anthony of Egypt. He was born in 251 AD, and he is generally considered the father of modern monks. That he lived a life, he was a hermit, he lived a life pretty much in solitude most of his life. When he was a young man, he heard the voice of Jesus speaking to him in the gospel, where Jesus says, go sell all you have and give it to the poor and come follow me. And that's what he did. He was a wealthy guy. He sold all that he had, and he went and he lived out in the middle of the desert. St. Anthony of Egypt lived to be, and we're not exactly sure how old he was when he died, because records weren't that good back then, but he was about 101 when he passed away. I mean, he was advanced age kind of thing. But during his ministry as a hermit, during his lifetime, he was a mentor to many other people who wanted to be hermits. He had many dreams into his advanced aging process, many dreams about what life would look like. Some of them were good dreams, some of them were nightmares. But he had a lot of dreams about what he could do with his life, what God was calling him to do. At 60 years old, there were Christians being persecuted in Alexandria, Egypt, and he went to them to minister to those people who were in jail just for being Christians. When he was 60 years old, he went to minister to them and to provide the gospel to them and comfort them and be their sort of like chaplain, knowing that he very well could have been martyred himself and persecuted himself. He was not. But that's the kind of guy he was. He had dreams of he could do things. He could do things and do things for God. Pope Francis, probably the best known Christian in the world right now. Pope Francis, think about this. He became Pope when he was 76. How many people do you know have taken a major promotion at their job at 76 years of age? How many people? Not a whole lot, right? 76, that's usually the time when you think about yourself at 76, you think, well, I'll retire, you know, that's when I'm going to be in retirement. I'm going to use my savings to travel or paint or whatever it is I've always wanted to do. Francis, Pope Francis, is now 78 and he started a new career path. How many people say, well, you know, my most important days are after 76 in terms of my career. My most important career days are after 76 years old. That's pretty cool. How great that would be if we could all think that way. You know what? The best years are not behind me, but they're in front of me. I got stuff to do, and it's God's stuff. It's God's ministry. This is important, I think, because Matthew's gospel is a study in how to face a hopeless world. Pre those dreams, Joseph and Mary are hopeless, and the whole context is hopeless. Just imagine, put yourself in Joseph's shoes for a moment, that the woman he is engaged to, that he is supposed to marry, is found pregnant with a child that he knows is not his. If the father can be found, the penalty, according to the Old Testament law and tradition, is that both the woman and the man shall be stoned. Not Joseph, the man with whom she committed the adultery shall be stoned. Joseph, who's looking to get married, who's looking to have the most important moment of his life, trusts this woman implicitly. I mean, Mary, she's terrific. She is a faithful woman. And yet, he's being tested in this moment that should be the greatest moment of his life. He's being tested, and it's horrible. It's awful until the dream happens. until the angel says, "Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife." Until the angel says that this child shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. The dream breaks everything apart. And I don't think we realize when we read the beginning of Matthew how hopeless it was. The culture in that time was totally hopeless. Joseph, we've just gone through the Christmas season, and we're still in the Christmas season until Tuesday. But we've just gone through getting all the Christmas cards from people, and sometimes we over-idealize what Joseph and Mary was like on our Christmas cards. We forget that before all the stable and manger and angels and all that kind of stuff, Israel had been overrun by the Roman Empire. Israel felt that they were vassals of Rome and that Rome had their boot on the back of their neck, that they were paying too high taxes to Rome, that Rome enforced everything at the end of the spear or a sword. We forget that the whole reason there's a split between the Old Testament and the New Testament is that the Jewish people did not hear from God for 500 years. The last page of the Old Testament takes place about 500 years before the first page of the New Testament. God was silent during that time. So we forget how hopeless the situation was, how people must have felt that nothing looked good, that nothing at all looked good. And we forget that Jesus' birth, if you subtract out the angel choir preaching to the shepherds and the star, would have largely gone unnoticed. No relatives are reported being at the stable. Jesus was born to parents who had nothing particularly fancy about them. They weren't elected positions. They weren't written about in history. They were not people who were well known in any particular way, shape, or form. And so there's a lot of hopelessness drenched in the background of this Gospel of Matthew. Yet, we refuse to be hopeless. The message of Matthew is, you can't be hopeless. You must look at God as breaking things open and making things new. You must look at God being active and coming into our dreams and giving us greater hopes than we ever thought we could have had. You know, I do a lot of talking with people. I visit quite frequently with people, both inside and outside of the church. And it's almost maybe pretty close to 98% say, you know what, life isn't like what I thought it was going to be like. You know, society's just not what I thought it was going to be. The best days are behind us. And I get that. I hear that. There's a lot of hopelessness out there. But Matthew's gospel says there's more to it than that. There's more to it than that. All of us can point back to a time when Sunday schools were full and churches were full and the blue laws and all that kind of stuff. We can all think of those days when, what did you used to do on Sunday afternoon? Visiting on a Sunday afternoon, right? You used to go around to the relative's house. I certainly did that when I was a child. Now, if you said that to Miriam or Elizabeth, somebody in their grade, you know, you're going to go visiting on Sunday, people would look at you like you were crazy. They wouldn't know what you were talking about, would they? Things have changed so radically. Just walk into a room and you used to see children and adults playing games or talking with each other. And now, and I'm guilty of this as well, we've got these little things that keep us from talking with other people. They keep our thumbs busy. But we're not talking with each other. I always say to the kids, well, technically I am talking to somebody. It's somebody in the Philippines or a friend of mine on Facebook. So technically it's still interaction, but that's pretty much a weak excuse, I think. But pretty much 98, 99% of the people I talk to, I would guess, say things aren't what I thought they were going to be like. When I was a young pastor, a younger pastor, I used to think, oh, that's just people talking. But I find as the older I get, I start to have those same sorts of questions. Every institution in society that we used to think, you know, this is the bedrock institution, this is so important for America, whether it's government or church or the banks or hospitals, everything has seemed sort of tainted by something, whether it's scandal, whether it's economic abuse or misuse, people stealing money or big business using its pull to drive people away. I mean, pretty much any institution you can think of has just gone down. The only institution that I've read about recently that still has a very high rating, a very positive view in the United States, and it hasn't changed much over the years, is the military. But other than that, pretty much every institution from the top on down has gotten terrible, terrible ratings from how people feel about them. Yet, and like I said, I get that. But Matthew says, the best days are not behind us. Sure, we're going through something very difficult, but we've been there before. Have you not read your Old Testament and your New Testament? Have you not read how back against the wall Mary and Joseph were and what God was able to do there? God says, I'm going to break things open in a way that you cannot imagine. And you know what? If you didn't go through this right now, perhaps you wouldn't recognize it. Perhaps you wouldn't appreciate it. Maybe Joseph wouldn't have got it here if he hadn't been really worried about what was going to happen with Mary and this child. If he really wasn't backed against the wall saying, I don't know what I'm going to do with this woman who I think has committed adultery. So my hope is that we as Christians can start dreaming again, and we can enter into a dream. One of the greatest questions somebody asked me after I got back from the Philippines was, do you feel depressed after going there? I gave a presentation at a church group, and they said, do you feel depressed after going there? And I said, absolutely not. I can't feel depressed because you know what? The people in the Philippines, even though they had so few things, so few resources compared to what we would consider resources, their churches ran on a shoestring budget. Some of the churches had not enough money to pay anybody, even their pastor. The pastors didn't know whether they were going to get paid or not. I mean, there were huge amounts of things, of troubles that were over there, governmental problems, all sorts of issues that caused them trouble. And yet, I didn't find one person in the Philippines who said, oh yeah, our best days are behind us. I didn't find one person over there who said, you know what, this isn't working out right. Each and every one of them had hope. And of course, I was talking to Christian people because that's why we went over to talk to people in the church. Each and every one of them knew that the Bible is a book of hope. And they said, oh no, we put our faith in God. Sure, things might be terrible now. Things may have been terrible for 10 years now, but we're taking the long view. We know how this book ends. And it doesn't end with failure and disaster and death. This book ends with the victory of God. And we know that we are going to be part of that victory. We know the end of the story, and we will not give up hope in our daily lives. Amen.